final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our final guest today is old enough to remember living in the internment camps for Japanese Americans during World War II. Mitsuko Asai, as she was known then, grew up on the family farm in the Hood River area. She and her family went to three camps, including Tule Lake, then came home to find racism still raging back in Hood River. But Mitzi pushed through. She called herself Mitzi, got an education, studied in Japan, raised a family, taught for many years, and retired ultimately to Ashland. Now Mitzi Asai Loftus is celebrating a reworking of her memoir, published by Oregon State University Press as From Thorns to Blossoms, A Japanese-American Family in War and Peace. Mitzi Asai Loftus, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
This is the successor to a 1990 book, Made in Japan and Settled in Oregon. Has your perception of life gone through some further permutations since you published that book?
Yes, and I should correct that I was not educated in Japan. I was educated in Oregon and just spent 1 year in Japan teaching English under the Fulbright program.
Mm-hmm. Studied in Japan was what I said, yes.
Well.
Tell us about your family, but your mother was a picture bride. Tell people what that means.
Yes, it was very common for men, both in Asia and Europe, to arrange for their marriages without knowing who they're going to marry. They had to depend on their families, like their parents, to send them pictures. And my father picked my mother's picture out of a group of maybe three or four. And she was 12 years younger because he came as a young man, but he had to work for many years to save enough money to afford a place to live. And then that's when he sent to his mother and said, I'm ready to get married. And so she was the one who was chosen. And she was 19 and he was 32 or so.
And you were one of eight kids, is that right?
Number eight, yes. Wow. My father delivered all of us, but me with great difficulty. He had to get a doctor and a nurse to help. The others, he delivered himself.
Hmm. It sounds like a fairly happy and normal life on the farm and in Hood River, but the treatment changed right after Pearl Harbor, you point out. I mean, how did some of the kids in school begin to act toward you?
The same students that I went to school with from the first to the fourth grade acted like they never knew me, so I had no playmates during school, during recesses, and I walked to and from school a mile and a quarter each way every day for all through the rest of my seventh and eighth grade, at which time I graduated from an elementary school, eighth grade elementary school, boarded a bus, and went to town to be in junior high school with the town kids. And at that point is when I changed my name.
You decided to be Mitzi at that point?
Yes, I didn't tell anybody, not even my parents. So when my report card came home, my father looked at it and smiled, and he looked at me and smiled. He didn't ask me any questions. I didn't talk about it, and the subject never came up. I've been Mitzi ever since.
You were not quite 10 when the order came to go to the camps, and how did your parents break the news to the family?
Well, we knew it before my father, actually, and I think we must have had a little warning because I remember we had to take our own sheets, and my mother was carrying sheets down the stairs and tripped and fell to the bottom of the stairs and had an injury to her arm that bothered her the rest of her life. I just figured it was a new adventure. I was going to get to ride a train for the first time. I didn't know where we were going, and I pretty much didn't go anywhere except in my hometown. So for me, it was kind of an adventure. But for my older sister, who had just graduated from high school, it was a different story.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking to Mitzi Asai Loftus, who lives in Ashland now, about her recently reworked memoir, From Thorns to Blossoms, A Japanese-American Family in War and Peace. Mitzi will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland for an event on Sunday, April 7th at 4 p.m. Now, you and your siblings were all American citizens. Two of your brothers were already enlisted in the military, one of them drafted. How did you make any sense out of what was happening, other than I get to take a train ride?
Well, I was too young to, you know, think that much about it. However, when people talk about the surprise attack of Pearl Harbor, I have to shake my head because my brother, who volunteered in June of 1941, his furlough was postponed with no reasons given. And a month later, it was postponed again with no reasons given. And the third month, they were canceled. He said, all of our furloughs are canceled. We are being shipped to the coast of California. And what was that about? That was before Pearl Harbor.
Girding for an attack is what was the expectation. Yeah. So the train ride turned out to be not much of a train ride because you had to have the shades down the whole time, so you couldn't see where you were going. 4 months you and your family spent at Pinedale near Fresno. Tell the story of the guard in the tower and what happened when you kids knocked the ball out beyond the fence.
Well, there were four guard towers around the camp, and there was a soldier on duty 24 hours a day with a gun. And as a child, I thought, that guy really doesn't like his job up there. And so on some occasions when we'd get a ball thrown over the 8-foot fence, I was always nominated to talk to the soldier to get a ball back. And he was a good-looking guy. We threw the ball over the fence quite often. And it was the first time I'd ever seen fig trees, which were just outside the fence. And I had one of the soldiers actually pick a fig and pass it through the fence to me. And it was the first time I'd ever had a fresh fig.
Wow. So from Pinedale, which was really just an assembly center to get you to the camps once they were there as they were being built, you moved on to Tule Lake at first. And citizens, American citizens, were allowed to take a bus to shop in Klamath Falls, which your sister did exactly once, you tell us in the book.
Yes. You had to go through a gate that was guarded by soldiers, of course, to go out. And I never left the environs of the camp ever. But my sister found it so unpleasant in Klamath Falls, she never went back again. I've forgotten the...
What kind of treatment did she get in Klamath Falls when she was there?
Well, people didn't wait on her, or if they did, they were very rude. She ended up not buying anything, and that was the end of that.
So you were moved again after Tule Lake to Heart Mountain in Wyoming, and you write at that point in the book, I was a happy child in camp. What was the happiness from?
Well, it was happy that we were moved because Tule Lake became a segregation center for all those boys who said no to this very important questionnaire that was put to all people from age 17 on. My father was 69 years old, also answered those questions like, I will serve on the armed forces at any time I'm called upon. You're asking a 69-year-old man who is not allowed to become a citizen until 1952 or had been here over 40 years. But my father was smart. He knew what that was all about. He answered yes to the questions, so he was considered loyal. Mm-hmm. And so we were sent to Heart Mountain. Heart Mountain was desert-like. There were rattlesnakes and ticks. And other than that, it was a happy place for me to play with a lot of kids.
Oh, because there were more kids around than there were on the farm.
Yes.
Back in Hood River. How did your family manage to keep title to the farm while you were in the camps?
Because we accused my father of being Scotch, not Japanese. Having had 8 children and fed and housed them, he ended up owning 3 orchards by the time the war started. And he had no mortgages, and he had money in the bank. There was no way the government could take the property away. He had put the property in my brother's names because all of us who were born in the United States
citizens.
Were citizens. So they were actually preschool age when he put the property under Asai Brothers, which was a smart thing to do.
It is, yeah. Mitzi Asai Loftus is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her recently reworked memoir is called From Thorns to Blossoms, A Japanese-American Family in War and Peace. You can see Mitzi in person at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland Sunday, April 7th at 4 p.m. So upon return to the Hood River area, how chilly was the reception? What kinds of things were there that indicated attitudes toward Japanese-Americans?
Well, we were not served in most businesses, and that made a real hardship for farmers because that meant hardware and things like that that were very important we could not buy. I remember my brother, who was barely old enough to get a license, he and I had to do the business end of the farm because my parents would not go to town after the first time they went and were treated so badly. So we had to, one time, put a big tank on the truck and drive 15 18 miles to Parkdale at the foot of Mount Hood to get gas from the man who said he would sell to us. Eventually, the government agencies came to help us and got some of the oil companies to deliver gas to our underground tanks.
So as you point out, there were still some derogatory signs up in 1950 when you graduated from high school. You were class valedictorian. You were a scholarship student at the University of Oregon. You excelled in many ways. You got engaged to Don Loftus, then got word you had been awarded a Fulbright scholarship to study in Japan. So you talk about, engagement aside, having some anguish over accepting that scholarship.
Well, I dreamed of teaching abroad ever since I was in college, and I knew that the Fulbright program required 3 years of experience. So I waited for the third year, and I applied, and I thought, boy, I'm going to have some wonderful adventures. I hope I don't meet anybody until I'm 30 years old. And, of course, I met Don that very year. And so he presented me with a ring at Christmas, and I said, I don't think I'm ready for this. And he said, well, will you keep it till you're ready? And I put the ring in the glove compartment of my car. And then I finally announced our engagement in March during spring vacation when I thought I was not going to be accepted. And, of course, I was 2 weeks later, I was accepted. Then I made the decision to go to Japan anyway and stay engaged for a year.
What was that like for you to be in Japan? I mean, especially because, you know, all the tensions in your life here. So, you know, being discriminated against because Japanese-American and then going to Japan.
I never passed for Japanese the whole year I was there. In fact, I was thought to be a prostitute on the train because of the wild colors I was wearing that the person of my age is not supposed to. It was very important because from the time I was in the seventh grade, I began to build this monkey on my back. And I decided it wasn't fun to be Japanese anymore, so I tried to run away from my heritage. But I was not aware of how much that was affecting my life. And that year in Japan helped me reclaim my heritage and with pride.
Now, your parents were still alive, at least your father was still alive when you returned from the Fulbright, right?
My parents have been gone for over 50 years now.
Okay, but I just wonder...
When I went to Japan?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we're a nonverbal culture, so I don't really know what they were thinking or what they felt, but I'm sure they were happy that I had that experience. And, of course, I got to meet my relatives for the first time. I'm the first one in my family to ever meet any of our Japanese relatives.
Wow. And how we were able to communicate with them? How good was your Japanese? It wasn't terribly good from you telling
us. Oh, yeah.
Book.
I had my father's masculine, rural, uneducated speech, but well understood.
Huh.
So I was able to communicate. And during the year, I improved my Japanese so much that my parents gave me a funny look when I came back and spoke to them.
You've given many talks over the years as a teacher and since about the camps. You've watched as this country worked to make amends to the families swept up in that situation. Is there something else you think still needs to happen?
I have been given over 50 talks, and after every adult group that I speak to, somebody comes up to me and says something like, Mitzi, the things you said never happened. They're all lies. And that still happens today. That's why I feel so important to give talks and to have written this book. Because young people, high school age, they get it. Their minds are still open. But adults, some of them, just don't get it.
As you see the rise of anti-immigrant fervor in the country, are you further concerned?
Yes, and it doesn't matter what minority group, somebody's going to suffer if people do not wake up.
All right. It's a sobering book in places. It's a joyous trip through your life. It is actually quite fun to get to know you through the book. It is called From Thorns to Blossoms, A Japanese-American Family in War and Peace, the work of Mitzi Asaya Loftus, who now lives in Ashland. Thanks so much for sharing it with us here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for today's exchange. We are online at jeffexchange.org. All of our interviews get uploaded there and to podcast sites, Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Angela Decker of JPR News is our senior producer. Charlie Zimmerman, our assistant producer. Student assistant Zach Beagle is at the controls today. Maxwell and Terry Longshore composed our theme music. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. Please join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange and have a great day.